Great. What are you doing, Anton? What's that theme song to? What is it? Josh? You know everything. When it comes to music, you know everything there is to know.
Pretty much.
Huh?
Pretty much.
Pretty much, huh? Well, there it is. Look at what a beautiful job that Gloria and Mike did. This is what we're going to be talking about today. There is your DNA fingerprints. And you can see your name. And that's what it looks like. And just as I discussed in previous times, some of you are homos and some of you are heteros. And you can see different alleles and genetic diversity because they're not all the same size. And Harry will be talking about some of this stuff related to. Is there a question? Sure. Everyone's happy. Glory's happy?
Yes.
You're positive?
Yes.
Okay, great. So am I. Okay. So you will have that probably next Tuesday and be able to play with it and look at it and think about it and all kinds of other things. Tomorrow's discussion. Tomorrow's discussion gives you a little bit break, as you inferred from reading papers. This is a little experiment that I tried this year just to see how it works. And so tomorrow's discussion will be a discussion. It'll be a review, meaning that you come in and you can ask questions regarding whatever things that may concern you. Jason? Thank you. Things that would, you know, confuse you or whatever. And Mike and Gloria will be helping you. But then we're going to see a couple films. And it may be the films that are on the syllabus, or it may be something different depending upon my completing the viewing of an extensive library that I have of films dealing with DNA and privacy and all those other kinds of things. And so the first part of the discussion will be questions that you'll have, conceptual questions about anything that you might want to talk about. And then the second part of the, well, actually be the 75% of the discussion will be on some films. And there will not be, obviously, a quiz for this week. So you have a break in the action on that, which I'm sure you're very happy about. And don't have to trek to my office at midnight on Friday. But then, coming up next Tuesday, you'll have your take-home exam, which is going to be... Gloria, is there a question?
I was just wondering, did we have a quiz all year?
You didn't have a break. You didn't have a break in your class. In any case, you'll have your take-home exam, and then... yeah, you have your take-home exam, which will go out on Tuesday. But then next Wednesday, that's a week for Wednesday, and you have to start thinking about this now. Because one of the reasons why you're not going to have a quiz this week is that you're going to have to start planning and working on the play that you're going to perform a week from Wednesday in the law school. And Mike and Gloria have been working on this play, which I wrote originally, but they've been revising it, and we'll hand it out on Thursday with your specific roles. When you get the script, it will have specific people assigned to specific characters and specific roles, and in fact, it's a DNA trial, and it deals with a murder case, not a real one, one that we made up a long time ago. But this is going to be something that you're going to have to get together with each other over the weekend because it involves a lot of conceptual things. It's not, I mean, it's a very serious play, and it's a real trial. There's a judge, and there's a prosecutor, and defense attorneys, and witnesses, and science experts, and all of that. And the play is just sort of scripted out in general, and you're going to be left to fill in the dialogue. But a lot of it's going to be... population genetics and allele frequencies and all kinds of material that you haven't quite had yet, which will be the subject of your articles for next week. And so instead of discussing these articles, you're going to be performing them, in a sense. And I must say that this has always been the highlight of this quarter. It's quite a remarkable experience. This is the only class, I'll toot my horn a little bit, I'm the only professor that's allowed to use the moot courtroom of the law school. And it's actually quite amazing that they still let me do that, because about 4 years ago, right after 9/11, you'll have to enact your murder scene, and it was pouring rain outside. And so they decided to enact their murder scene inside the law school while all the classes were going on. And one of the students brought a starter gun and fired the starter gun in the hallway to the law school, which at some point someone screamed loudly, and then red blood went all over the victim on the floor, screaming, and every single human being in the law school came out. And then the police cars came in about 2 seconds. And I had a lot of explaining to do. And as you can imagine, a nice letter of apology had to go out to the dean of the law school, who is a good friend of mine. But the fact of the matter is that we're still allowed to use the moot courtroom. Last year, we couldn't get it. This year, we rearranged everything in order to get this moot courtroom. And so it's a real courtroom. And so we'll talk more about this on Thursday. But that's coming up for next week. Are there any questions about anything? Betty, you ready for dinner tonight? Those of you who are going to dinner, don't, you know, eat all this stuff in the reception, because last week people were waddling out of the faculty center having had two meals. And so keep that in mind. Any questions? Heather, you're happy? Never been happier in your entire life? It's the happiest day of your entire life? Sky, you're happy? Looking rested? You don't have any exams this week or anything like that? Melissa, how are you feeling? A little better or still not so good? Still not so good. Nick, how are you doing? I'm a little sick too, huh? Huh? Loda, how are you doing? Did you have a good dinner last week? Was it enjoyable? Good. For all of us. Thank you. Okay. We have a real treat today, as I told you on Thursday. And this treat is something very unique, and it's on the DNA in the law. Here he is, right over here. And it's always a pleasure to have someone who's an alumnus of UCLA come back and talk to the class. Harry wasn't one of my students, kind of avoided my class.
I had enough trouble with microbiology.
Yeah, right. I'm just teasing him. But in a sense, he used to see me wander through the halls in the old days.
Running.
It's interesting. I was your age then. Mm-hmm. It's greatly interesting. Yeah. In any case, Harry's been involved in some amazing things. And I'm not going to go through his resume, which reads like, I mean, there's just nothing that he hasn't done and he doesn't know about DNA analysis in the law, you know, data storage, collection, doing the actual fingerprinting, crime scenes, samples from crime scenes, real crime scenes, exhumations, and as he's going to tell you, it ain't CSI, believe me. And so I had asked Harry to give you a real-life experience in what it's like to work in the Los Angeles crime lab. And he's been involved in some pretty high-profile cases, some of which you'll be able to talk about and some you won't be able to talk about. You can feel free to interrupt him and ask some really good questions. But I asked him to show you some real stuff. And so you're going to see some pretty gruesome pictures, and I'm warning you in advance. And those of you who don't want to look at it, just close your eyes and don't look, but I wanted Harry to show you the real life of using DNA testing in catching criminals and exonerating people who really served in jail, but were really much much. Well, we're innocent. And sometimes sat there for 25, 18, 20 years. So Harry's a real true Bruin. He bleeds Bruin blue and gold like I do. He's been working for the L.A. Crime Lab for now about a decade or so, right?
Almost 16.
16, wow. And he's trained in, I'm not going to go through all the different things, and he's gotten, as I showed you last week, some very, very, very high honorary citations from the Los Angeles Police Department. And are you the senior person in the DNA Crime Lab
now?
Yeah,
I am. Mm-hmm.
And he's really been pioneering a lot of the technology, and he's really been there from the beginning. And so let's give a really rousing welcome to Officer Criminologist Harry Klan from the LA Crime Lab.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. There's a laser pointer. Okay.
You have your microphone. Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the pointers.
Okay.
Anything you need, just call me.
Okay.
And I'm here.
Do I have to touch this to do it, to get it to advance?
Just right here.
All right.
It's bleeding a little bit.
I have to apologize for the title. This is actually DNA for Dummies was a title used in the fall at the California Association of Criminalists meeting. They gave me that title, and I said, okay. So I apologized at that time because, you know, people get real upset with stuff like that, but it's kind of a joke. It was actually designed for other criminalists who work in crime labs throughout the state of California, not necessarily in DNA units. So I was invited to speak to other criminalists about DNA typing. And my coworker, who actually recently resigned to become a stay-at-home dad, Carl Matthews, did most of the preparation and design of the PowerPoint presentation, so I want to give him credit. I actually am, my title is criminalist. At LAPD, we have three levels, 1, 2, and 3. Level 3 is kind of an assistant supervisor or lead criminalist. I've been a lead criminalist since 1997. And usually what they require is that you have testified and qualified in court as an expert in at least 3 different subjects. And for me, it was serology, crime scene investigation, and DNA typing. And blood alcohol, DUI type trials. And I managed to do that, and I impressed them sufficiently to be promoted. So I've been a criminalist 3 for 8 years now.
What's the highest level?
3. Supervisor is, supervising criminalists is one step above my rank. I have real no great interest in being a supervisor, to be honest. Well, I'll start out real quick. Again, I tend to talk fast, and I'm also a little hard of hearing. So if you have a question, you need to raise your hand and wave. Don't be shy, because I tend to look at one person, and they're over there, and I can't find out who's talking. So please wave your hand. Interrupt at any time. One of the main objectives, one of the 3 main objectives of forensic DNA typing is to basically produce a link between a person and a victim or a person in a crime scene. And it's pretty easy to do. There's a lot of reoccurring themes, by the way. One of them is called Locard's exchange principle. Have you heard of that? Have they talked about that? I can't really put it better than this, but it says that with contact between 2 items, there will be an exchange. And what that means is if you enter a crime scene, you leave something behind and you take something with you. Usually, in my way of thinking, it pertains to the suspect. He or she enters the scene, does the deed, and leaves. And they, in the process of doing that, they leave something. They leave a hair, or a fiber, or their blood, or a piece of tissue, or something. But they also take something with them. They take, you know, fibers from the carpet in the house. They take a memento, you know, underwear from the victim, or they take blood from the victim that was splashed on their clothing. They take something with them. The problem is that usually we're limited by what we observe and what we can collect. We're limited by technology sometimes. There's a couple scenes I'll show you today where we could find nothing. Now we know there's something there. I mean, we shed 50 to 100 hairs a day. These people this person probably left a hair there, but I mean, how do you find that? In a 1,000-square-foot house, you know, good luck. I mean, it could have been, it fell off and it kind of drifted on the air and landed on the wall. And we don't see it. And it happens. We know it happens. But sometimes we get lucky. We see something. We see a smear on a window or a little smudge of blood on a banister, or we see something on the floor and people, it gets their attention. They look a little closer and then they have that kind of eureka moment. They go, oh, check this out. Come over here and look at this. And they found it. And it's the one thing. And usually, for me, I'm impressed by some of the trace evidence, meaning the minute evidence, you know, the hair or the fiber or the tiny little smidge of blood that, you know, you wouldn't have noticed in a year if you had lived in that house. But somebody just happened to notice it, it caught their attention, and it made the case. And then the suspect's sitting there later on being interviewed, and they're just head down, and they're just shaking their head like, you know, I can't believe my bad luck, you know, but it's amazing. A few other uses of forensic DNA typing to exonerate suspects. The FBI used to quote the number of 33%, and it was pretty accurate. 33 to 37% of the time, when they bring a suspect to you and they give you an oral swab or a blood sample and we compare it against the evidence, about a third of the time we would exclude that person as a source of the DNA, whether it's blood or semen or hair. I'm a little congested, by the way. I'm sorry about that. I've only had it since Thanksgiving. I'll be getting well probably within a month. So, we'll exonerate suspects, and that's very rewarding too. Our detectives, you know, they're not happy with that. You know, we know it's the guy. We're sure of it. You know, we have a lot of reasons to believe it. He even confessed, and then we compare the DNA, and guess what? Detective Goyaz, got some news for you. It's an exclusion. No way. You guys need to recheck that. Do it again. No, it's an exclusion. You know, it's what it is. Sorry. Now, it doesn't mean, an exclusion doesn't necessarily mean that the person didn't commit the crime. In the case of a rape murder, a rape homicide, it could be that we find semen and the semen doesn't match the suspect in custody. It doesn't mean he didn't commit the rape, but he's excluded as the source of that semen. There's more investigating that needs to be done to truly exonerate him of that crime. And sometimes it's possible and sometimes it's not. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And then, of course, identify victims of mass disasters. The best example is the World Trade Center disaster. I have a whole PowerPoint presentation on that. It's actually quite amazing what they accomplished with what they had. They went as far, I believe, as humanly possible with nuclear DNA, mitochondrial DNA, YSTRs. They did it all. And they had, along in parallel with the developments there in typing these burnt and cremated remains of human beings, 3,000 of them, they had a parallel development of computer technology to track all the data. It's truly remarkable. And some other time we can talk about that, I suppose, but... Dr. Kerry Mullis, he's the guy who, quote, invented, or at least I figured, what's the correct term, Dr. Goldberg, realized the possibility of doing DNA replication in a test tube. And
you'll see a film about him on Thursday.
There's a whole article, The Unusual Origins of PCR, I believe, in Scientific American. I recommend reading it. He says he was driving along PCH and the idea hit him, and he ran with it. But PCR, and I'll just give you a quick description of it, it's a way of amplifying DNA. If you have 50 cells, 50 sperm cells, we cannot type 50 sperm cells worth of DNA. It's not enough. But if we crack the cells open, break the cell walls, release the DNA, we can actually use enzymes and cycles of heating and cooling, and within about an hour and a half, take 50 sperm cells worth of DNA and amplify it millions, if not billions of times, into a typable quantity of DNA. Some people have described it as a molecular Xeroxing. It's not a bad description. This slide shows just what I was describing. It's the exponential amplification of DNA. You start out with a molecule. After the first cycle, you have two copies. And after the third, you have 4 copies, and then 16, and 32. And you repeat that. Well, here they say 35. We actually use 28 right now. It's plenty. And there's reasons why we do 28 and not 29 and not 35 and not 100. It's so sensitive that, and human DNA is ubiquitous in the environment. There's human DNA here, on the counter, on my sleeve. It's all over. And if we amplify too much, we start to get this sort of artificial mixture. We don't really want all that extra noise. We kind of want to get only what we're hoping to get, which is the person who left the blood or semen or the hair. We don't want all the DNA that's on the hair that just resulted from the hair floating down and laying on a desktop and landing in someone's saliva or, you know, on a piece of gum and getting the chewer's DNA. We want only the DNA from the person who shed the hair. So it helps us target an amount or a number of cycles. In our case, in a forensic lab, it's 28 cycles. And Dr. Paul Rabinow actually described it like this. I think the best part of it is where he says, it makes abundant what was once scarce. Back when I started in crime scene, or at least in the crime lab, we were using bloodstains the size of a half dollar. And this was just in the last 15 years. 1999, 2000, we were using bloodstains that were the size of, in 1989, 1990, we were using bloodstains that were this big. And you go to a crime scene and the detective would invariably say, so what do you think? And we'd look at a stain this big, go, that's going to be close. And we'd be able to tell them, you know, ABO blood type, A, B, AB or O, maybe a few enzymes, and that'd be it. And the frequencies would be 1 in 150 or 1 in 35. Just, it could be 5 people in this room who could have been the source of that blood. That was the best we could do at that time. But then arrived PCR, and the first use of PCR was with something called DQ-alpha. The alpha dropped out here, but...
That's exactly what you saw today for your genotyping, was the DQ-alpha.
DQ-alpha was it. It was state-of-the-art in 1990 to 1994, and we loved it because it was so cool. You know, it was just different. It was like, you know, riding a moped, and then the next day someone gives you a Ferrari, and you're like going, hey... I'll take the Ferrari. This was it, and we loved it, and it was there for a few years, and then one miraculous day they go, hey, check this out. Not only do we have DQ alpha, we also have something called polymarker, which added 6 more markers for a total of 7. I'm sorry, 5 more markers for a total of 6, and it only used 1 to 2 nanograms of DNA, which is wonderful. It's a fraction of an ounce. A billionth of a fraction of an ounce of DNA.
Each marker is a different gene. Okay, so you look when Harry says one marker, that's one gene and different alleles.
Right.
And if you have 7 markers, that's 7 different gene and as many alleles as there are in the population.
Right. And I'll just jump ahead a little bit. Let's say, for example, you have a DQ alpha result of 3, 4. It means you inherited a 3 from, say, mom and a 4 from dad, and we call you a 3-4. That combination might occur in 10% of the population. Well, you take that 10% and multiply it by the next marker or gene, say 10%, and that's 1 in 100. The next marker might be 1 in 10, that's 1 in 1,000. We keep adding on markers. With 6 markers, once in a while, not all the time, we could get a combination of genetic marker types that would occur in maybe 1 in a million people. And the defense attorneys would go, well, hey, you know, how many people are in LA County? And they always go there because they know us, we know them. And we act like we've never heard the question before because, you know, we have a good rapport with the DAs and the defense attorneys and the judges, and we have a straight face. They go, so how many people are in LA County, Harry? About 14 million. So how many people would have this profile? Yeah, maybe about 14, plus or minus 3 or 4. And they go, so there are other people who could have been the source of this blood? And the answer to that is yes. And then they usually say no further questions because they want to elaborate on that after I'm off the stand. They don't want to have me on the stand going, well, you know, we have them on videotape too, but, you know. So we have we had DQ alpha and polymarker. And then arrived, I'm trying to think when the kits first started. Probably mid-90s, and then definitely the use of STRs. I'm jumping ahead. STRs definitely blossomed in about 2000.
That's VNTRs.
Right. Short tandem repeats. We use 13 of them. It's a commercial kit produced by Applied Biosystems, and it's in use around the world. There is actually a new kit called Adenofiler. These are all commercial names that types, I believe, 15 markers in one reaction. To accomplish 13, we actually have to set up two PCR reactions, which has its own problems, but we manage. But we use non-coding, meaning that they don't have a purpose as far as coding for a protein that we're aware of. There's no way to link many of these that have been chosen for forensic use to diseases, so they did that deliberately. They wanted to dispel the idea that law enforcement would have your profile in a database and that when you weren't looking, we would sell it to insurance companies who would check you for disease, you know, risk. And they chose these particular 13 because they have no linkage to disease markers. Well, we can use as little as half a nanogram of DNA, and we get beautiful profiles. In fact, it's kind of like a delicate balance. We can use a small amount of DNA and get a beautiful profile. But just if we were to jump down to 0.4, the profile starts to look kind of ragged. But if we were to use 2.0 nanograms, it's completely off scale. It's like feedback. It's too much. So we prefer to use between 0.5 and 1 nanogram of DNA. It's not a lot. I should know this because I talk about it all the time, but it's about 150 sperm cells or about 75 epithelial cells from the mouth or the vagina or the blood, white blood cells from the blood. It's not a lot of cells, and we can usually manage that. We do have problems, and I'll show a few examples of that. But the power of discrimination using STRs, using 13 STR markers, typically results in numbers with 14 to 23 zeros. It's very common for us to have numbers to the power of 18, 10 to the 18th power, quadrillions and higher. And when you're talking about a world population of 6.5 to 7 billion people, it's meaningful. It means that that profile is unique to that person or that, you know, individual or that defendant. That's the instrument we actually use. We have several of them. They're wonderful. They're very reliable, and they're in use around the world. It's called a 310 genetic analyzer. And the process in a nutshell is that we label via PCR each of these DNA molecules with a fluorescent tag. And the kit we use now with the 13 markers has four different dyes. There's an internal standard, and I don't want to get too technical, but we use these dyes, and these labeled fragments of DNA go through the capillary, which is a thin tube. It's very fine. It's filled with polymer. And they flutter through that column of polymer past a laser, and then they fluoresce. And then there's a CCD camera that picks up their fluorescence, and it assigns it to a size. And based on that size, actually, it converts that information to a peak, and that look a little bit like this. This is actually looking at all the colors together. There's four different colors, red, green, blue, and yellow. Black is how we designate yellow because the yellow doesn't show up. It's a practical thing. The red is very regular. This is the internal size standard. And you look here at 75 bases, 100, 139, 150, 160, 200, 240, 300, 340, 350, and 400, and 450. And it's great because the ladder or the yardstick is in with the sample. So it's running along with the sample, and we can get precise sizes of these different fragments. This is a male. That's the X peak, the X chromosome peak, and that's the Y chromosome peak. I can't tell you much beyond that because it gets kind of jumbled up, but that's definitely a male. And you can see that there's green peaks every so often. Those appear as a set, and if you were to subtract away the blue and the red and the black for yellow, you would just have the green electropherogram with one, two, three, four different loci or four different genes. This is an actual profiler plus ladder.
These are all size separated. It's really no different than a gel electrophoresis.
Exactly. It's just in a tube. It's in a small capillary, like a long human hair. And we have representations of the most common alleles at the different loci. I should light up the loci here. Amelogenin, D8, D21, and D18. These are, amelogenin is what we use for gender determination. It's helpful. We also have three of the 13 STR loci. We just give them shorthand names of D8, D21, and D18. And you can see that this peak here in the unknown sample lines up with peaks in the ladder. And they're sized precisely. For example, 144.89 bases, 208.78 bases. And it's the same. If I run it today and run it tomorrow, we'll get the same size, plus or minus just a fraction. If they run it in Tokyo, Japan, or in Berlin, Germany, they'll get the same exact profile on the same sample, which enables us to use databasing. This is what one of our reports looks like. This is from an actual case. What you're looking at here is an item. In this case, it was a vaginal swab from a rape victim, and it's item 25. S designates sperm fraction, and E designates epithelial cell fraction. We have a method that we can actually separate the sperm cells from the vaginal epithelial cells and put them into separate tubes. We exploit characteristics of the cells. Sperm cells are kind of like BBs. They're small and dense, and the epithelial cells are kind of like balloons. They're fragile, and they float. So we can spin them at different speeds and effective separation, and once we have the sperm cells pelleted at the bottom of the microcentrifuge tube, we can pipette off the liquid containing the vaginal epithelial cells and put them in a separate tube. Then we can clean up both fractions, break the cells, lyse the cells, release the DNA, and type the two separate parts of what was formerly a mixture. It's pretty amazing, actually. It's simple science, but it works beautifully. But look here. You have the victim profile, and right above it, item 25, the vaginal swab, the epithelial cell fraction, we have a beautiful separation. There's not one hint of a Y chromosome there, meaning it's carryover. It's to be expected. It does happen. We don't always perfectly separate them. There's a lot of reasons why, but in this case, we were able to get out all the male DNA, and you see the match, X to X, 1517 to 1517, 1618 to 1618, and on.
Keep watching this because you're going to need this for your own trial. You're going to have data like these. And so as Harry is talking to you, take really copious notes about what he's saying because you're going to, in a sense, you're really getting a lecture on the conceptual basis of things that you're going to be talking about in a week when you do your DNA trial. A little less sophisticated, but the principles are the same.
You know, I make jokes and stuff. I'm vigilant for the right science and the right result and good quality control and all that. You know, I don't know this guy. I don't know, you know, he may go, look, I did not do it. I was in New York that day. He may very well have been. So we have to be vigilant. We have to do good lab work. We have to make sure our controls are correct and true. But when you see something like this, you know, they'll get the guy in custody. They'll interview him. And he's like, well, I didn't do it. I don't know her. I never laid eyes on her. I've never been to that apartment in my life. You got the wrong guy. Well, then you won't mind if we take a swab and swab the inside of your mouth and do a DNA test. Okay, I guess, sure. Well, we'll swab them. We'll take it back to the lab and look at the profile we get and compare it against the sperm fraction of the vaginal swab. XY, XY, 17, 17, 15, 17, 23, 26, and so on. It's a match. And then what we would write and actually tell the judge and the jury is that the combination of genetic marker types exhibited by item 25 sperm fraction and the suspect occurs in approximately 1 in 100 quadrillion individuals. It's him. And these guys, I mean, some of them are sitting there at court. Sometimes they're like kind of mad dogging you. You know, you're sitting on the stand and then you say this and then they go, oh. And then the jurors usually sit back and put their arms up. They've made their mind up. At least that's what my interpretation is. I mean, I could be the third witness out of 25, but once I've said these words, the jurors usually kind of look like this, and they look at the guy. It's amazing. I mean, it's just body language and stuff, but, you know, sorry, man. I guess you were there, you know. And what can you say? They usually, after this, the defense will usually say, no further questions, and then it's a matter of consent. You know, suddenly he'll say, well, look, you know, I met her at a club, we went home, it was consent. And that's none of my business. I'm gone by that point. So,
Radina.
Is there any rule as to when this evidence can be presented during the course of a trial, or can the prosecution bring it up at any time?
Anytime. I've been in cases where I'm the only witness, and that's it. There's no eyewitnesses other than the detective. The DA will say, hey, Harry, check it out. The detective will be on tomorrow at 9 a.m., and you're right after, and I'm done. You know, that's it. So it could be that I'm the second guy on the stand. I talk about DNA for 20 minutes, and it's over. I'm off the stand and on my merry way. It could be that it's a complicated investigation. Maybe it's a sexual assault homicide, and there's the coroner. There's the neighbor from next door who saw the suspect leaving covered in blood. They may have, you know, four or five civilian witnesses before me and the detective, and then I testify. There's really no formula for when I present the DNA evidence. It's up to the DA.
The only reason I ask is mm-hmm. because aren't jurors supposed to be completely objective? And if you present this evidence and that just, like, have them make up their mind before all the evidence is presented, is that a fair trial?
It's the DA's choice. They have their goal, and I'm kind of like, I don't testify for the DA or for the defense. I try to be, you know, just objective. I try to be an advocate for my results, and I have really little control over what their purposes are in using me when they use me. I have suspicion sometimes that it's tactics. They decide when they're going to put the DNA guy on, and yeah, I mean, sometimes you're on and they ask the wrong questions. And you're like, when? You did go to law school, right? And they ask some really terrible questions, but you go, oh, well, I was up there. They had all the opportunity in the world to ask great questions, and they didn't. And the defense will go, oh, no further questions, or no questions, Your Honor, thank you. And you're like, guys, there's about five obvious questions you should have asked, but oh, well, bye-bye, walk out. Yeah, it's out of my control.
There's two things here, Radina. One, the evidence that Harry testifies about are scientific evidence, and that's just something that a juror keeps in mind objectively. The juror could reject it if they want to.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just one of many pieces. So it really doesn't matter in the trial when it's presented because it's one of many different things. Maybe the only thing, maybe one of many things, but it doesn't affect the objectivity because that's a piece of data. That's that's evidence in terms of doing that. So just keep that in mind from that point of view. The other thing is before Harry goes on, this slide that he's showing you is central to your trial and central to the article that you'll be reading for your discussion next week. So when he talks a little bit about it, and he's not going to go into too much detail, but just note that because you're going to need to look up a little bit of background in a genetics book in order to understand some of this stuff for your trial next week. Daisy, you had a question?
What are the typical questions that someone would, or what you said there are five questions that people answer that kind of are the essential ones to a case?
Oh, no, I was saying that in a given case, sometimes if I had been to the crime scene, I have, you know, I've read the crime scene report and I know a few things. Well, when I go to court, I'm anticipating, you know, these five questions or these 20, and sometimes they don't ask them. And sometimes I've met the DAs later or the defense attorney and go, why didn't you ask me about this, this, and this? And they go, oh, well, you know, before you were on the stand, we touched on that topic, and the judge said it's off limits. You know, a perfect example. Once they asked me, did you see sperm on the vaginal, the slide prepared from the vaginal swab? And I said, yes, I did. And they said, what did they look like? I said, they looked like sperm cells. They had the head and the tail. I go, in fact, we got them back to the lab so quick, they were still swimming. Oh, my God, objection, Your Honor, and they went to full battle stations. They sent the jury out, and they said, Your Honor, that's prejudicial. And they had their private conversation. They usually turn on like a sound machine, so the witnesses can't hear the judge and the attorneys talking. And it's lost on me. I'm deaf in my left ear. I couldn't hear anything anyway. And they're over there looking and pointing at me, and they're arguing. And before they brought the jury back in, the judge said, no more comments about swimming sperm. I go, okay, no problem. But, you know, I said it spontaneously. I wasn't trying to be, you know, funny or clever or cute. It's just that I said it. The cells have a very distinct morphology. They have the head and they have a tail. In fact, the sperm cells were still swimming. They were still viable. And that was the wrong thing to say for that particular case. Yes. Yeah, no, you. Go ahead. I can't see your name.
It's Yuditha.
Hi.
Okay.
What kinds of questions do you usually anticipate? Not like, I know you were saying that usually, like, you know stuff, but like, what kinds of things do they ask you when they put you on the stand?
They usually ask, you know, tell us a little bit about your training experience. I'd say at least half the time I say, I graduated from UCLA. And so I went to UCLA too. Great. Good. And it's really funny because you say, I went to UCLA, and the judge will say, I went to USC. And you're like, okay, great. You know, it's funny. They ask certain things. They ask you, were you present at the crime scene? And sometimes I actually was, which is news to a lot of people because they think that I'm strictly in the lab. I've had, on two occasions, one was the Ennis Cosby murder trial. Bill Cosby's son was murdered right off Getty Center Drive in 1997, I believe. And the attorney had no idea I was at the scene. He had no idea. I don't know how he could not have known that. But at one point he said, Mr. Klan, you don't know anything about the source of these items of evidence. You weren't there. You didn't collect them. I said, excuse me, actually I did. I collected all the items. And he said, what? What are you talking about? I go, I was at the scene. I was the lead criminalist at the crime scene. And I did the DNA typing at the lab. And he's, Your Honor, I mean, he didn't know what to do with that. He thought I was talking, you know, about hearsay, that I had heard about the evidence being collected on the roadside or on the shoulder of the 405. And I said, no, I collected the evidence. And so.
Hold some questions, because here he's going to, well, you'll have a chance, but he's got to move a little bit.
Sorry, my throat is killing me. But how do we get to these numbers? Well, you look here, this is just three loci. The frequency of, say, a 17 allele is 0.223. Well, this is a so-called homozygote. So that individual inherited a 17 from mom and a 17 from dad. So you take the frequency of that allele in the population and you square it. You multiply it by the frequencies of the next locus. And say a person's at 15,17. The 15 occurs in about 8% of the population. The 17 occurs in about 14% of the population. And you multiply by 2, and then you do the third locus. Well, just three loci. We already have a number of 1 in 76,000. We have 10 more loci to go. And we get to those huge numbers with, you know, in the quadrillions very quickly. There was a debate back when we were doing RFLP typing that you had to have a database of 10,000 people. And then very bright statistical mind said, well, you know, maybe not. Databases on the order of 100 to 200 people are probably sufficient. And they had lots of papers out. There were a lot of arguments about that. And they finally did settle on databases on the order of 100 to 200 individuals. I've heard examples that if you take a deck of cards, 52 cards, and you lay them out one after, you shuffle them very well, and you lay them out, and you record the cards in the order they occur, and then you stack them back up, reshuffle them, and then redistribute them, you're going to have, just from 52 cards, I believe it's 10 to the 67th power of possible combinations from just 52 cards. So you can generate very large numbers from very small numbers. You can generate virtually infinite combinations from small numbers. In my example, 52. So it helps people understand. I usually put it in terms of money. If you have,
Hold it, man.
If you have, let me see if I can go back. probably an easier way to do this, but I believe this number here, well, you can look at it. 10 to the 14th, if you subtract 10 to the 9th, which is a billion, that's about $10,000 for every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. And jurors understand that. I don't understand that number. I'm like, I don't know. But if you put it in terms of the population of the world and you tell them, say, 7 billion people, it's enough. If these were dollars, it'd be enough money to give every man, woman, and child on the planet $10,000. Or you could say it like this. If these were people, 100 trillion people, it would be enough people to populate 10,000 Earths with 7 billion people each. So it's a way of putting it in terms people can understand.
The last conceptual slide that Harry showed you with the P squared plus the 2PQ will also be on your take-home exam, because you'll need to understand that to analyze your own DNA fingerprinting data.
I skipped a few of the artifact slides because they're really not cogent enough. I mean, it's not something I need to get into. But we deal with mixtures a lot, and it makes sense because you have, you know, hand-to-hand combat with knives, people get cut, their blood's spilled, and it mixes on the floor. You know, I show up at the crime scene, they're like going, okay, we got dead guy number one in the living room, and the suspect is almost certainly wounded and bleeding, left the trail out the front door and down the street for 5 blocks, and he caught a bus, and he's gone. Well, if we were to do DNA typing on selected stains at the scene, it's not unusual for us to encounter evidence of a mixture. 3 alleles, with a few exceptions of triallelic people, anytime you have more than 2 alleles at a locus, you're probably looking at a mixture. Here's another situation here. But this is kind of unique, actually. There's 4 alleles. That could be at least 2 people. But one of the things about STRs is they have an artifact we call stutter. And we have a parent peak of 16. There's almost certainly going to be a smaller peak, 1 repeat less, and it would be a 15. Typically, the computer is programmed to recognize stutter positions. 15 is the stutter peak for 16, 12 is the stutter peak for 13. But the computer is also smart enough to know that typically stutter peaks are less than, say, 10% of the parent peak. But this is obviously more because the computer labeled it. At that point, I would look at the data and make my own decision whether it's a real peak or not. In this case, Carl decided that is a bona fide peak and not stutter for 16 and not stutter for 13. There's a little bit of an imbalance here, which is not remarkable. What I'm getting at is it could be a mixture of male and female DNA. It may be that it's a mixture of 2 males, but we just don't know until we do other stains at the crime scene.
Remember, 1 locus, 2 alleles, 1 locus, 2 alleles in one individual, but an infinite number of possible alleles in a population, and that's what this is dealing with.
Sometimes even PCR DNA typing meets its match. We have a lot of crime scenes that, you know, I've been to crime scenes just a few blocks from UCLA where we know as well as we can know that the individual was murdered on, say, a Monday night in August, and we discovered them on Wednesday, and, well, where's a good narrow place? You know, a kitchen about this wide, I'm not kidding you, the body was bloated so much that it filled in between the 2 kitchen counters. It was just, and if someone were to ask me, how long has this guy been dead? A month? I don't know. 2 days. And it's just because of, you know, the process of decomposition and the gases and the fluids, and, you know, it's horrible. But we also lose DNA sometimes like that. So, you know, right now in LA, it's a big city. It's 500 square miles, there's probably bodies out there waiting for us to find them. And, you know, with our weather, you know, hot and cool and wet and dry and hot and cool, the DNA is degrading. And sometimes we try to type it. It may not even look like blood. It may look like brown chocolate, or it may look green. But it seems to be blood. It appears to be blood because of the way, the shape of the stain or the amount of it. We try to type it, and we'll find that it's degraded. And it has a very distinctive shape, and you can see it when I draw the lines. These are so-called degradation curves. We lose the larger alleles. The smaller, we lose the larger loci. The smaller loci are to the left. And the smaller fragments win the race through the capillary. The larger fragments take more time to pass through the matrix of the polymer. They get retarded, basically. And so there's more drag on them. The smaller fragments move quicker, further, quicker. And they come out first. So the larger pieces suffer more degradation. And we have these degradation curves. It's very disappointing when we see that. I'm going to save this one for next. There's a story with this one later. I'll pass it up for now. And also pass this one up, too. I should have cut these out. That brings me to CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System. This is the FBI's baby. They zealously guard this database. We have a lot of what I call intrusions into kind of our turf. DNA analysts in law enforcement labs are given top secret clearance. It's nothing, you know, there's no secrets that, like, you would care to know, but the FBI guards their database zealously, and we all have to pass backgrounds in addition to those backgrounds that LAPD put us through. We're fingerprinted, and then we have access to the database. We can search profiles from crime scenes that occur in the city of LA against the database stored up at Richmond, up near Berkeley, and they in turn will compare all the profiles from the state of California to the national database in Virginia, Quantico, Virginia, at the FBI Academy. The FBI Academy has a database of about 2.8 million people as of December 05. That's convicted offenders, by the way. Most of the 50 states, including California, require samples, oral swabs, taken of all convicted offenders in custody, no matter what. There are about 126,000 forensic profiles. These are blood stains, semen stains, vaginal swabs. Yes?
Is that for, against California Penal Code, like the federal government can keep the criminal's record too? Or is it stay in the state, or they just take ones that are federal offenses?
Well, I, as sort of like the gatekeeper or the person entering a profile, am responsible for sort of certifying its reliability and that it was, you know, produced according to the standards. Then it goes into the database at the local level here at LAPD or LA County Sheriff. Every week or so, all the profiles are uploaded to Richmond, California, to the state database. They compare them against all the profiles in the state of California. And then every week or so, they upload everything in the state of California that was newly entered to the national level. And those are compared against all 50 states, I believe Canada and Puerto Rico. And the FBI basically says, okay, great, we have the data. They don't really know about what got the data there. They hold you, me, accountable for is the person who entered it. And they basically only have the profile, the STR profile at the 13 core loci, and that's really all they know. When a hit occurs, if we match a convicted offender to a crime scene sample, they will notify us. They'll say, okay, we have a hit. They call it a cold hit, meaning that we had no idea that this hit would occur. We have a blood stain at a crime scene in Los Angeles at a murder, and it matches a convicted offender who's in custody in Arkansas. They will put me together with the Arkansas criminalist, and we'll talk about our match, and we'll confirm it. And then we'll retype the evidence and the convicted offender sample. And then once it's confirmed, then we'll notify the investigators. So the FBI is sort of just a conduit. CODIS is their software, and it's actually called NDIS, National DNA Index System. They're like the custodians of the database.
There's no jurisdiction issues here. It's just databases that are being looked at. Yeah. And if there's hits, then the jurisdiction takes place wherever the crime occurred, and then the state-to-state deals with and things like that. So it's just a database. Matt, you had a question before?
My question was regarding, I guess, the statistics for figuring out, I guess, the probability of having another person with those specific genes.
Yeah.
And wanted to know if you guys take into account on like gene pairing, for instance, it's unlikely for someone to have blue eyes or blonde hair, but someone with blue eyes is more likely to have blonde hair, and thus sometimes that's not necessarily perfectly accurate.
Now, are you asking if we can do DNA typing and tell the detectors?
So what I'm wondering is for your statistic as to what the probability that someone else has that specific, those specific alleles, do you take those sorts of facts into consideration, or do you just do the straight statistics of probability, assuming that they're not related in any way
right,
to another?
Right, they're independent. The type at one locus has nothing to do with the type at the next locus or the third locus. They're all independent.
Okay.
And they have no influence over the result at the next locus. There was a lot of talk about that in the beginning. They call it linkage. They were afraid that two genes might be close enough on a chromosome that they are linked and that there is some effect of their proximity
on the
arm.
If you have gene A, there's like 100% chance you'd have gene B, for instance.
Right.
Okay.
So these are unlinked. Okay. So they're not in equilibrium. Or is that right? Oh, I'm drawing a blank. But they're unlinked. And therefore, we can use the multiplication rule and multiply the frequency of the occurrence of this result by at locus 1, by that at locus 2, by that at locus 3.
Okay, so then you're not using any loci that, say, code for hair color or, like, eyes and that sort of thing.
No. But you could.
You could. There is a company.
It would be independent of the others as well. And so the rule is that if a gene is unlinked with another gene, it's behaving independently of the other gene, and therefore the probability of that particular allele in a population will be independent of the other allele, even if it's blonde and blue eyes.
Okay, that answers
it. So you'll know quite a bit about this in about a week or two. Matt. Radina, you had a question.
That was earlier. Can I ask?
Mm-hmm. And you'll have a lot of chance to ask questions at the end, but here he has some pretty fascinating stuff to show you, and so at the end there'll be plenty of time for a lot of these questions.
I'll just wait until
the end. So go ahead.
I'll wait until the end.
Ben, you had a question? Okay. Go ahead, Harry.
Okay. There are, I'm drawing a blank here, there are at least two markers that do occur on the same chromosome that cause some concern, but they're of sufficient distance apart that they've done statistical analyses and showed that they're not linked in the sense that one goes with the other every time, you know, during recombination. YSTR's markers are... We can basically zoom right in on the male DNA. So if a male, I'm getting off topic a little bit, but if there's a male who's had a vasectomy or he doesn't produce sperm, if he were to commit a rape, we have no sperm to find. If he ejaculated, the seminal fluid still contains white blood cells. So the trick then would be, how do we separate white blood cells from vaginal epithelial cells? Well, we can't do it easily. There is one way, but most labs don't have the capability of doing that, but we can cut through all the cellular red tape, so to speak, and go right for the male DNA with YSTRs. They occur only on the Y chromosome, which only men have, and we can type him. All those markers occur on that one chromosome, so we can't use this the product rule for those, and they have to approach it in a completely different way. We don't get the same statistics with YSTRs.
And these databases, as we'll talk about later on in the quarter, these databases are good, in other words, as Harry said, to see whether if there's a crime in Los Angeles, someone's sitting in a prison someplace else,
yeah,
and to be able to get that person. And it's also good for cold cases, you know, cases that are 20, 30, 40 years old, of which these crime samples have been saved, because it's all supposed to be saved generally.
Yeah.
And you can look at things that happened in the 50s or 60s and then find someone who committed these crimes, and that happens as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking of one right now. There's a location over on Fairfax where a young girl was murdered in 1968, and we still haven't solved it. There's a number of reasons. Maybe it was a one-time thing. The guy did the rape and the murder and never repeated his crime. Or he may have been, maybe 50 at the time, and 30 years have gone by, he's 80 years old now, and he's dead. We may never solve it. I don't think we ever will. It's a shame, because we have the profile awaiting a match, but he's just not in the database. Now, CODIS is great, and it's great. When you get these cold hits, the detectives light up, it makes your day, because it's a crime solved. It's somebody we take off the street, and they won't harm anybody again, theoretically. And it can prevent crimes, too, they say. We're about ready to start a big property crimes grant project. There's a theory that the guys who commit the burglaries kind of graduate to more serious crimes, rape and homicide. And there are papers and studies that seem to bear that out. Well, New York had some great success with basically going out to the scenes of burglaries and swabbing doorknobs. And these guys cut themselves all the time. They break a window, and they get cut, and they leave blood. And we swab it up and type it, and they put it into the database, into CODIS. And 2-3 weeks later, we get a hit. And we link this burglary on, 123 Main Street with this burglary on 534 Main Street that we may not have linked any other way. And now all of a sudden we know the same person is responsible for both burglaries. And in fact, the West Side Rapist, who was captured about 5 years ago, he told us, we knew he was good for 6 rapes. We knew it. And we knew it the day after the rape, because I was doing the DNA typing overnight. So we knew each new assault, it was the same guy. When we finally caught him and interviewed him, he told us of about 92 burglaries he had committed that we were completely unaware of. We had never hooked him up. He was doing hot prowls, meaning there's someone home and he's like in the living room, or you're in the living room watching TV and he's in your bedroom going through your jewelry box. He was daring. He did a lot of casing, testing doorknobs. He told us, I can't believe how many people leave their doors unlocked. And it was true. We would take the dogs out at a crime scene and go try to find his scent, and the officers would go to a door, open it, and they'd be in the person's living room, the dog would be going crazy, and they'd say hello, and someone would say, who is it? It's the police. Your door is unlocked? No, it's not. Well, come on downstairs, I'm standing in your living room, and that a lot of people left their doors unlocked, and he took advantage of that, because he wasn't shy. He'd check the door, if it was unlocked, he'd open it, and if he confronted someone, he'd say, oh, I'm sorry, does Bob live here? And no, there's nobody here named Bob. Oh, my mistake. And he'd leave. He did that a lot. He had no fear. He wasn't shy. And then there's the dark side of CODIS. There are problems. In this state, in California in 2009, January 2009, all arrestees, drunk driving, burglary, domestic violence, will be swabbed and their profiles entered into CODIS. It's done. It passed by vote in, I think, November 2004, and it's a done deal. So like it or not, we all will be, there's a possibility that should we be arrested, we will be swabbed and profiled, and that's coming. And, a lot of people were against it, but unfortunately not enough people went out and voted to turn it down. I have my own personal feelings about it, but it doesn't matter what I think.
But this is something that's coming up, as Harry said, in California. It's now law, but it's coming up in a lot of other states.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about this, the question of whether it passes constitutionality and muster, because the extension of this is just doing dragnets and going out and just randomly.
We do them in L.A.
Exactly.
We do them in L.A. all the time. If there's a rape, the detectives will round up 35 guys who look like the suspect, and they'll swab them all, and we'll type them all, and we'll compare them. We don't enter them into the database because there's some pretty strong prohibitions against us entering them. But I'm noticing that as the months go by, people are getting a little more flexible with the rules. And there's a lot of political power, too. There's a lot of people who have the clout, and they can make things happen. And we get these profiles entered in. And maybe someday every baby will be typed at birth. Oh, LAPD stats. As of September, and I just updated them, we have about 274, I believe the number is, case to offender matches. And I believe this number is slightly higher. It's about 125 case to case hits. And then this is just miscellaneous stats. But sometimes we do get a hit, in a rape, for example, but the DA will reject the case because, there's a consent issue, or the victim can't be located, or she doesn't want to proceed with the prosecution. So there are rejects. And I'm going to skip ahead some of this stuff here. That's pretty funny. Y chromosome. I have to admit to one of these. Where is it at? Identify aircraft. I am the best. I can identify an airplane from... I can just see like a tip of a wing go behind a cloud and I know what it was. And my ex-wife used to go, how do you do that? I go, I don't know. It's a gift. But now I know better. It's a gene. And I'll skip SNPs. All right, we'll get... Do we want to take a break or do we want to continue? It's 4:40. Okay. Then we'll do the crime scene stuff. Good group. Hi.
I was interested in like what you said about the arrests and how they mm-hmm. they so it's just an arrest, no.
Where's Gloria? Okay. You ready, Harry?
Yeah.
Good. It's okay. It's good.
Need some more water?
I'm good. I have it right here.
Exactly what they need. Okay, if I could have your attention again. How you doing, Summer? Just all right? Busy week. What's today? Tuesday already.
Okay. Is it? Yeah.
Okay, does anyone have any general questions for Harry before he moves on in terms of what he said? Hannah.
Who's Hannah?
Right here.
Oh, hi.
When you were showing us the XY for the women, would it just be the X then? And it wouldn't be
double dose of X.
Double dose.
Two X chromosomes and it shows us one peak. Because they migrate the same, and so they basically
overlap each other.
Yeah.
Yuditha.
Has it ever happened that someone who is innocent of a crime has been convicted, has it ever been that the DNA testing has been wrong, and someone who's innocent has gotten convicted anyway because it read wrong?
Well, what could be the reasons for it being wrong?
I know that the numbers,
what could be the reason for
that
the DNA test?
Someone else had the same alleles at that locus, as unlikely as that might be, isn't it possible still?
Not with the STRs, to my knowledge.
Okay.
13 markers, it's exceedingly unlikely, except in the case of twins.
Okay.
But no. Okay. Haven't seen it.
Unless it was the wrong DNA sample.
Right.
Oh, that could, yes.
You know, okay. And that's a very... That's a viable defense. I mean, a good defense attorney will ask, we talk with them on the phone before we get on the stand, and they'll say, did you get the right sample? Are you sure? How do you know? Well, the label said, John Smith collected on this day, and his thumbprint's on it, and okay, well, just checking. Are you sure you got the right one for the case? So,
I mean, that was used in a defense in a very, very, very famous trial.
Yeah.
O.J. Simpson.
That's one. That's the one we never talk about at work. People, it's funny because they'll say, in that one, the case with the glove. We always call it the case with the glove. And it's like, I think I wrote in an email, we have this institutional post-traumatic stress syndrome over that case, so we don't talk about it at work, but yeah.
But Harry's the expert, and I'm not, we're going to talk a lot about this later on in the quarter. But I think that the rule generally is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Harry, because you know more about this than I do, but from a law point of view, Yuditha, you never want to rely on just one piece of evidence.
Right. There could be an explanation for it. Yeah.
Go ahead, my man.
A perfect example? Finding somebody, someone's semen in their own car. Whoop-de-doo. But our detectives go, we have them. I'm like, no, it's, no. He might have been on Lover's Lane with his wife or girlfriend. His semen in his own car, are you kidding me? No, it's,
but
his semen mixed with the victim's vaginal epithelial cells in her body was found on Lover's Lane. Now you're talking. But even then, maybe they had a fight afterwards and he she left in a huff and he drove away and she was murdered. He had nothing to do with the murder. Yes, he did have consensual sex with her. But that's where the police investigation has to dig a little deeper. They need to, you know, wear off the shoes, the soles off a few pair of shoes to find out what really went on.
As Harry said, and he'll show you some pretty serious stuff, let's not get CSI'd here. I mean, seriously, we're not dealing with television here. I mean, we're dealing with real victims of horrendous crimes and real suspects who have the potential for being executed for these crimes.
True.
This is really serious stuff. And so even though what Harry does is phenomenal and really, really, really puts a lot of bad people away, one has to take into account that in a trial for someone's life, one needs to have a variety of different pieces of evidence because, as he just said, it could be, you know, this or it could be that or it could be that. Remember, critical thinking. What are the possible other explanations? And then you exclude them. Remember, that's the scientific method, and it's incumbent upon all of you to keep thinking that no matter what applies, whether it's in DNA in the law or whether it's with GMOs or whether it's with, you know, the Avery experiment or whatever. What are the other possible explanations? And I think that's really the trick here.
There was a case involving the murders of Albert and Edna Patton a few years ago, and they were the founders of the Harlem Globetrotters. And they're like a national treasure, but I don't think any of us have heard of them. You know, I hadn't until that point. But they were murdered, and two men were arrested, and the victim's blood was found on clothing in their possession. They were arrested in a motel, and the SWAT team burst in. These guys were laying on two different beds talking, and the cops kicked the door down and took them into custody, and they had blood that we later determined to be from the victims on shoes that were at the foot of each of the beds. And that case was going on, and I had been involved in the beginning. I did some quick DNA typing as a favor to the captain, and I got the result, and that was all I did. And then it went on for 2 or 3 years, late in the game. I mean, like the day before the first, you know, the opening argument in the court, I was sitting in the DA's office with another criminalist, and the DA was sitting there talking, and I was just sitting there looking around, and he said, "Harry, make yourself useful, read something." And he goes, "Start with binder 3. And I grabbed the binder, I go, "What am I looking at?" He goes, "Well, that's some of the DNA reports from the private DNA laboratory." Now, remember, this is like the afternoon before the start of the trial. What, you know, why bother? But I, you know, I had time to kill. I'm reading and I'm looking at stuff, and I said, "So where's this mixture?" And this alleged mixture was one of the victims with the defendant on, I think, from a shoe. So I'm looking at this profile, and I go, "This is not a mixture." And he said, "What?" And I go, "This is not a mixture at all. This is a single profile, and it does not match the defendant." And the DA, I mean, his brain, like, he just, "What are you talking about?" I go, "This is not a mixture. Is this the right item? Item whatever, 37? This is not a DNA mixture. This is a single profile." That was the last thing in the world he wanted to hear. And all of a sudden, he's like going, "You better be sure about what you're talking about." And I go, "I'm positive." He goes, "Well, we have three experts back in Maryland who say otherwise." I said, "With all due respect, they're wrong." And that was, he called me on the phone, and he said, "Harry, this is heavy, and you better know what the hell you're talking about." And I said, "Look, it's simple. It's plain as day. This is not a DNA mixture. This is a single profile, and it matches, I think it was the victim. It does not include the defendant." And I ended up being a witness called by the defense. And talk about, you know, being on the hot seat. I was sitting up there. The jury was sitting to my left. And the DA was just, he was getting personal. Like, "What the heck do you know? You have a bachelor's degree. You don't know nothing. We have PhD experts who know a lot more than you do who say otherwise." And said, "I'm sorry, I do know those doctors, and I believe there's been an honest mistake here. This is not a mixture profile. This is not." And I stated my case, and it resulted in a hung jury. that's like, you know, I say, oh, good job, Harry, you stood your ground. It's a very honorable thing to do. But when I got off the stand, my habit is I shake hands with the attorneys on both sides, and I leave. I walked up to the DA, and I put my hand out, and he turned around like this. And the detective was sitting there, and I walked by him, and I put my hand on his shoulder. I said, hey, Mike, have a good afternoon. And I put my hand out, and he swiveled around away from me, too. And I thought, come on, this is unbelievable. I mean, I'm not your witness. But they said, oh, I heard what you did. You were a hired gun for the defense. And I said, I just testified. I testified to the results. I gave my opinion. Could I be wrong? Maybe. I don't think so, though. The other experts in our lab, they also looked at it, and they go, holy smokes. How did we get this far on this evidence? I said, I have no idea. But it was literally like, you know, the stroke of midnight. I mean, ultimately, though, they tried this guy for the third time. He was convicted. But I found out, I got a phone call from a producer of like of Nova or Frontline. And she told me that this defendant who's in a prison in California still talks about me, saying that Harry Klein, that guy at LAPD, he was trying to defend me. And I said, that's his point of view. I wasn't trying to defend him. I'm not saying that he didn't do the murder, but all I'm trying to say is that he was not a contributor to the DNA in the mixture taken from that shoe. And the shoe had problems also. They brought the girlfriend of one of the defendants into the motel room, and they had her in the doorway, and they said, whose shoes are those? And she says, oh, those are my boyfriend's. Well, from her point of view in the doorway, and no one else knew this except for me, she saw one pair of, my brain's thinking of pair, one pair of shoes on the floor at the foot of the bed. They were like Nike Asus, like hiking boots, like kind of like mid, you know, like not high tops, but around the corner, outside the line of her sight, was another pair of identical hiking boots. And she might have very well have thought those were her boyfriend's, but his were the other ones. They weren't, but they said, she said they're his. I go, yes, she did, but she wasn't aware of the fact that there was a second pair of identical hiking boots 5 feet away on the other side of the bed that she couldn't see from the doorway. They go, ah. I go, what are you talking about, ah? That makes a difference. I mean, it's interesting information. I mean, the jury would probably like to hear this. I don't know that the jury ever heard it. I did my job. I my stature as like one of the, you know, the guys on the team went from like here down to probably around here somewhere. But I did the right thing. And, you know, it was easy to do, but I was a little hurt because, you know, I'm supposed to be like the scientist and the good guy, but they do pick sides. Whether you want to be there or not, they grab you by the arm and go, come on, you're on our side. You're on the winning team. You're not on the defense side. But the defense attorney, she said, you did great. Thank you. And I said, well, I'll just do my job. I just called it like I saw it. And that's the way it went. But you have to pick a side. So, or I'm sorry, you have to stick to your guns.
Let them go.
I picked a side. I picked the science side. Hollywood homicide. This is a crime scene. Hollywood has a lot of murders. Literally, Hollywood area of LAPD. And they're unique and interesting and very violent. It's just Hollywood. I don't know why, what it is about that division of LAPD. This was a victim who was known to, she did a lot of internet dating. She arranged a lot of sexual liaisons via the internet. And ultimately, one of these people that she met murdered her. And he came over, we believe, you know, you get a vibe. Carl Matthews, he was at this scene. He said, I don't think he went there with the intention of, you know, murdering her, but he almost certainly went there with the intention to burglarize and, you know, steal stuff. There was forced entry. We often see that. The chain was broken. You can see on the plate on the hanging from the chain. And there was like this sort of the strike plate on the door jamb laying on the floor. He had worked his way into the apartment. She probably said, here's my address, see you at 7, and he got there at 6:30 and went to work, you know, and may or may not have been aware that she was inside. The place was ransacked when we found it. This is not uncommon either. And he's looking for stuff, money. He opened Christmas presents. This was Christmas time. And in fact, the date's on there. Or actually, I'm sorry, that's the photo count. But he opened all the Christmas presents, you know, looking for the iPod or God knows what. And he probably had already killed her, and he started looking through her stuff. There's the presumed murder weapon. He cleaned up before he left. You know, it's a very bloody scene, and he probably got a lot of blood on himself. And once he sort of calmed down a little bit, he probably went in the bathroom. They do it a lot. I've seen him take showers. And they always leave the shower running. You know, the hot water steams the whole place up. And he did it. He cleaned up a little bit. There's a washcloth, bloody washcloth in the bathtub. And in the bedroom, there she is on the floor. We often see this very cluttered places, and, you know, she's dead, and there's usually a smell. She was probably only dead for a day, and look at her. You know, the heat's on, and it's a cool December night, and the heat's on in the apartment, and stuff starts to happen. The decomposition process begins. She was definitely beat about the head. She was probably punched in the face or hit with a blunt object, and she bled into the orbits of her eyes, and then later was killed. This is multiple stab wounds. She tried to defend herself. This photo, it's not the greatest, but it shows defensive wounds. So she wasn't caught by surprise. She did put up a fight. But, you know, he's armed with a knife, and she's not. Sometimes we get lucky, and in this one we did. On the bed, it's a little out of place. There's a workman's glove with blood on it. And this was his undoing, actually. At the time, we thought it was remarkable. Carl collected it, and he had reasons for it. He was thinking of contact DNA, wearer's DNA, so to speak. You know, he's wearing the gloves, he's sweating inside them, and he's leaving his cells. Now, the epithelial cells that you see on your skin, they are enucleated. There's no nucleus. They're keratinized. You slough them off at the rate of like 600,000 a day or something. But he's sweating, and sometimes there's enough sweat flowing outward that it carries some nucleated cells along with it. Those cells are deposited inside the glove, and that's exactly what happened. Back, by the way, too, another point of this is she has some pretty good fingernails. So the coroner's criminalist, working alongside with the LAPD criminalist, they will do scrapings of each finger of each hand because we're hoping that she got them. And guess what? She did. You see the peak imbalance at amelogenin? There's a lot of X, her, and there's a little bit of Y, male. And the other hallmarks of a mixture, remember I told you, greater than two alleles at a locus? I'm pointing this at myself. Right here and here. Well, look at this. Here's the victim's reference sample. What happens is the coroner takes the body, they do the autopsy, the coroner's criminalist or the doctor will collect a little bit of blood, usually from the chest cavity or the heart, and because it's the best we can hope for. It's usually, assuming the heart's intact, it's not contaminated by stomach gas, acids, or other body fluids. They prepare a little blood swatch for us. They put some of it on sterile cotton. That's the victim's reference sample. That's the standard for that victim. So the victim occurs right in the middle here. You can see her profile. And the red arrows show what her alleles, which match with the mixture from the fingernail scrapings. And at the bottom is the profile Carl developed from inside of the glove. And check it out. They both happen to be 13, 14 at one locus. What's the chance of that happening? Well, 12%. But they're different at D21. The male is a 30, 34. She's a 29, 32.2, which means, by the way, 32 four base repeats and two extra bases. That's just a little side, little bit of information. But up here, all four of these alleles, the two from the victim and the two from the suspect, are present on her fingernail scrapings. And again, the 13, 14 of the victim are present in the mixture. Not unexpected. They are her fingernails, so her DNA should be there. But there's also two foreign alleles, and those are consistent with the two alleles present at D18 from the interior of the glove. So we got a full 13 locus match. And, let me read from this here. Carl sent me an email. I knew there was a development in this case. He said, yeah, the victim arranged anonymous sexual liaisons via the internet. And he said, you might point out to your audience of libidinous college students that this is a very dangerous lifestyle choice for both men and homosexual males. Motives seemed more like robbery. The doors pried open, there was ransacking, the Christmas gifts were unwrapped, the TV was stolen. And there was male DNA on the interior of the glove. We see this. And by the way, there's the male, XY. He's got an X and a Y chromosome. She's got two X's, one X peak. And you combine them together, you got a lot of her and a little bit of him. He said that when they uploaded this in 2002, there was no hit. It was an unsolved. And it remained an unsolved until 2005. We got a hit in 2005. So this guy, he was arrested, I believe, don't quote me, I believe it was for something like as simple as DUI. They took a swab, typed it, uploaded it, and they got a hit to this sexual homicide. So he's been identified, this crime's been solved, and the trial's pending. So that was good news. Occasionally, we get involved with unusual samples, and this is in abortus. This is an example of a case where there's a rape that results in a baby. And sometimes the moms elect to not have the baby, and they abort it in like the first trimester, usually about 8 weeks. And what you're looking at here is here's the spinal cord, here's the ribs, here's the brain material. There's the heart. Well, sometimes we get samples like this, and we don't normally do paternity testing, but sometimes there's a need. We'll do it occasionally. But basically, it just Carl's point in including this, he told me, was the fact that people try to glamorize our job, and he says it's kind of hard to glamorize it when you're dealing with a fetus whose brain was literally ripped out of its body by vacuum curettage when they do the abortion. It's not pleasant. But in this particular case of rape, you have the suspect. He shares. Oh, I wish that wasn't on. See, I know my Macs. I'll do all the alleles first, then I'll talk about it. Sorry. Well, you look at mom, and let's see, dad's profile's here. Mom, and then the baby. And mom can donate a 14 or 16, and she happens to have a 14, which is found in the baby. The dad can donate a 15 or 16, and it seems that he donated a 15. Well, we do that for each locus, for all 13, and we can virtually confirm parentage. He's the father. Here's an exhumation of a suspect in an unsolved homicide. It was a double homicide in 1993. The victims were bound with duct tape, which is very common. And it's kind of good for us in a way, because in the process of binding these people up, you know, their heads and their wrists and whatever, their legs, they usually will leave us fingerprints in the gluey side of the tape or their hairs. And so it can be kind of like an unintended evidence collection device. In this particular case, that's what happened. There was one hair found that we were able to perform DNA typing on and produce a profile. Well, the investigation led them to an individual who they later determined had died from AIDS and had been buried at Rose Hills Mortuary. So the detective said, well, let's go exhume him and get a sample. So unfortunately for us, and I'm going to have to refer to Carl's notes on this one. He had some more information that I don't have. He said, sometimes investigations take us in unusual directions, and it's possible, albeit difficult, to obtain nuclear DNA from a corpse of an AIDS victim, 8 years buried in the cheapest of caskets. When they got the dirt off, the casket had actually just collapsed on itself. It was just literally the cheapest possible. And there's the remains of our suspect. You can see a lot of maggot activity around his face and skull. the casket itself had literally just started to disintegrate onto him. They did manage to pull some teeth. There's the one of the molars. Teeth are a good source because they're kind of like encapsulated, and any DNA-bearing tissue or dentin, I guess it is, it's protected from many of the effects of environment and insect activity and things like that. So it's an ideal choice. Another good choice is the femur. So Carl went after the femur. They used this kind of this ratcheting saw, and they cut into the meat of the thigh and cut into the bone and took a bone sample. And they also took some hair, but the hair did not work out. Ultimately, Carl did develop a profile, barely, by combining DNA from the tooth and DNA from the femur. What he had to do was he had to freeze it solid with liquid nitrogen and pulverize it, and then he had to extract the DNA out of that bone and tooth powder, and he obtained DNA. It didn't match. It was an exclusion. So he dug up this poor sap for nothing. But it did answer the question. Now, here's a case. It was a getaway car and a homicide. This individual had been bludgeoned and stomped to death, and the suspects had left the location. Witnesses saw this vehicle. It was later found and impounded. It had kind of atypical damage to the front. It's not real remarkable, but it's something to note. Supposedly, it had knocked a guy down. He was walking down the street, and they just drove up on him and just hit him, and he just fell down, and they got out and started kicking him and stomping him until they killed him. Well, we look at a lot of cars. I mean, L.A., you know, 4 million people, 6 million people in the city, 14 million in the county. It's a lot of cars. We have a lot of crime scenes in cars, and we do vehicle searches frequently, daily, dozens of them. They're not always easy. This one, despite the flash in the camera, it's not quite that bright. It's black interior, black velour, black leather. Even with the best lighting, we don't see everything. We use flashlights. It's not like CSI. We don't have a light that helps us find blood. We have to eyeball it. We have to use a flashlight and our eyes. Well, they looked the car over. They usually have 2, 3, 4 criminalists, and they saw nothing. But they did find a lot of cleaning supplies. And the car smelled clean. They're thinking, we might have the right car. You know, maybe they got to it. They had some time. After all, it's been 3 days since the murder. They've had time to clean it up. Well, one thing about criminalists, it's kind of unique, is that no matter where they're from, they're very, very nosy, and they like to look through people's stuff. You know, they like to go through their cars, their glove boxes, their trunk, look at their clothes and their underwear and tube socks. And well, we're looking through this car, and one of our criminalists spotted what we were looking for. It was a blood stain on the passenger door, on the interior of the passenger door, and it gave us trouble just as it gave them trouble. They overlooked it. It was kind of on the sort of the surface that was sloping away from us, so they overlooked it, and they missed it. When they were wiping everything down, they missed it, which was good fortune for us. And this blood stain, which is sufficient for DNA, matched the victim. So we were able to link this vehicle to the victim and the crime scene. Here's a great case, also in Hollywood, and we usually jokingly ask each other, well, what would Grissom do? And then someone usually says, shut up. And here's a crime scene, interior crime scene, apartment in Hollywood, again. family found these people, and they weren't answering the door or answering the phone for a day or two. Concerned family went in. And this, by the way, it's not real obvious, but there's no ransacking, no evidence of ransacking. It's pretty much the way it was when they lived there. The bathroom is orderly. My personal thing is that no toilet paper. I've never seen so many people in L.A. that don't have toilet paper. It's uncanny. They even had Halloween candy prepared for their nieces and nephews. And that was Halloween Eve. They were ready for family to come over, but they didn't answer the door when the family did arrive. And they thought, well, maybe they had to go out or something, and several days went by. But when they finally did gain entry to the apartment, they found their aunt and uncle dead. Gunshots to the face. There was a lot of frothiness around his mouth. That's all foam. He's aspirating his own juices, and he's breathing. He survived briefly after the gunshot, and his wife is dead. She's laying sort of on top of him. One single gunshot to the head. The person used the pillow as a silencer. I've seen this a lot. Not a lot. I've seen it a number of times that I actually look for it now. You kind of learn as you go. It's effective. Silencers are illegal. I mean, if you get caught by the cops with a silencer, you're going to jail for like a couple of federal firearms violations. So why bother? Just use a pillow. They use pillows enough. One thing about pillows, though, typically they have this is a side thing, synthetic foam. It's not feathers so often. It's usually polyester or nylon. Well, the bullet enters it and it kind of goes wow, and the pillow actually captures the bullet. I've seen that twice. And so we always go, wow, a pillow, we'll cut into it, hoping to find the bullet in there. Because usually when we do find them, they're pristine. We can match the bullet to the suspect's gun should we catch him. But this one is unsolved to this day. We think it was a professional hit based upon a few things. Circumstantial at best, but lack of ransacking, kind of a single-mindedness, boom, boom, using the pillow and leave. There was no fingerprints. The door was locked. The person. Oh, also, an unusual thing is semi-automatic pistols. You shoot it, the cartridge case ejects out the side. The person picked them up. There was 9mm bullets in both of their heads. It's a semi-auto. There was no cartridge cases. People don't collect their cartridge cases. This guy did. He picked them up and he left straight away. I've only seen that one other time. Most people are like, boom, they're like, oh, shoot, and they're out, they're gone. They don't have the time to go padding around the carpet looking for the cartridge case because they know the gunshot probably startled the neighbors. In this case, strangely enough, the neighbors didn't hear anything, probably because of the pillow. So that's that one, and I can go, Grace, I can go right to the next one now? Do we have time? To the next presentation?
Yeah.
Okay. We have time, right?
Yes, Gloria.
Gloria. Oh, I called you Grace. Sorry.
It happens
all the time. It's the G thing. It's a G thing. My kids, I have two boys, and they always go, Dad, don't do that. I was putting a bunch of songs on my son's iPod, and I go, how about Pink? He goes, no, Dad, no. I go, oh, you're that cool, huh? All right, let's start out with... Now, this one is highly graphic. So if it's bothersome, and it probably will be, just look down. I'll move on quickly. I'm not going to dwell on the bad stuff. Go ahead.
I just have a quick question about when you exhume bodies. Is there some sort of like complicated process you have to go to be able to do that?
I don't do it. The detectives will do it. They talk to the coroner, and the county coroner, he can make it happen. It's just a matter of getting a permit, basically. There's some legal paperwork to go through.
So it's not anything like, don't you think that there would be some sort of problems like with families not wanting their...
Sure.
It's not a big deal to get that done. Though.
But if it's a homicide investigation, the investigation takes precedence over the family's wishes. So. Okay. I'm trying to decide which one I want to start with. Okay, I'll start with this one. This was kind of a combined investigation involving LA County Coroner and LAPD, and one of the young criminalists, Yusin Fu, he actually worked on this case from the coroner's side, and he called it The Devil Made Me Do It. It involved the murder of a 21-year-old woman by Antron Big Lurch Singleton. He's a rap star, and there were several LAPD criminalists who were at the crime scene, as well as LA County coroner criminalists. This case involved cannibalism. That's Antron in the middle. I don't know him. I typically do know a lot of groups and stuff. I didn't know him, but you may recognize him. It occurred at 108th and Figueroa. And he was called Big Lurch. He was 6'7", and that was his own moniker. When they found him, he was walking around the streets of L.A., butt naked, covered in blood, and completely incoherent. He actually had blood all over his body, and it was later determined to be the blood of his victim. And there's just pictures of his tattoos. He was practically catatonic when they took these photographs. He was unresponsive. He couldn't even talk. They basically just kind of moved him around as they needed him to move. He's out of it. He can't. He's unresponsive. He's high on PCP. And this is about, I forget how many hours, 6 or 7 hours after the arrest. He's got the victim's blood all over his face. Note the size of his hands, the length of his fingers. He's got a lot of cut wounds on his hands as well as blood of the victim. We determined that later. We didn't know it at the time. Close up of his fingernails, he's got blood on his fingernails. This slide doesn't show it, but he's got something reddish-orange on his upper teeth. It's tissue. And we didn't have a real explanation for it at the time. Someone wrote here that in the middle, it just says that basically drug-induced sleep tranquilized. PCP is a horse tranquilizer. It was never intended for human use. They ended up later doing a lavage. They basically took the contents of his stomach out, and they found human tissue in his stomach, which was later identified as lung tissue. Now, the next slide is very graphic. This is the victim. She had been cut apart, literally cut open. Her lungs were removed. Parts of the lungs were missing. They didn't know where they were. Her mandible, her jaw was broken. She was alive for a while in the beginning. Based upon the blood pooling in the orbits of the eyes, the coroner determined that she had been alive as the attack began and later succumbed to her injuries. He had also bitten parts of her face and as well, as best they could determine. Now, the coroner was asked by the criminalist, you know, it's pretty tough to cut open somebody and take their lungs. He says, actually not. Over here, it's a different story, but up here, it's quite easy. It doesn't take a lot of effort, really, to stab and cut and then reach in and pull the lungs out. Bits of lungs, incomplete lungs. The victim was assaulted with multiple instruments, you know, blunt trauma, the knife. She had horrific trauma to her face. We all saw that. Her lungs were eaten. Spermatozoa were detected, but not profiled. I don't know why that would be the case, but it wasn't done. She had PCP in her blood also. They had been partying together. He Antron, had PCP. He was arrested on 4/10/2002 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And 24 hours later, almost 24 hours later, he still had a significant measurable quantity of PCP in his blood. As your liver processes the toxin or the drug, it decreases in the blood and rises in the urine, and that's what happened here. They're not surprised to see a higher amount of PCP in the urine. Interestingly enough, this quantity, 10 nanograms in a mil of blood, is not very high as far as PCP goes, but he was known to be a chronic user, so it's a problem for him. So after a two-week trial and a five-man, seven-woman jury found him to be guilty of first-degree murder and aggravated mayhem. Mayhem is when you just do horrific damage to somebody, whether they survive or not. You know, you rip their skin apart, or you break their teeth, or you do above and beyond. You know, it's not like you stopped after the first punch. You went on, and you did destruction. He was ruled sane, directed verdict of sane. And there's a tape I want to play if I can here, too. There's actually more to it on the LAPD side, and I'll show you that in a minute here. There it is there. I want to pop out of this and play the side. How do I collapse that? Oh, actually, let me go right there in this. I'm hoping you'll have a way to play that. Oh, there we go. Okay. Looks a lot different. As an aspiring rapper,
guy. His name is Antron Singleton, on trial for something unheard of, murdering 21-year-old Tanisha Isaias, slicing her open and eating her organs.
Could you believe that you are responsible and that you could have been biting on her lung and chewing on her body part? In a telephone interview from the county jail, Singleton says he was high on PCP at the time of the murder and doesn't remember a thing.
A lung.
And several different pieces next to her body. There were teeth marks on the lung and on her face. It didn't take police very long to find the suspect. Singleton was discovered just a few blocks away from the scene, walking down the sidewalk in broad daylight, stark naked, with blood dripping down from his mouth and onto his chest.
These booking photos were taken in a police holding cell a few hours later. Singleton's eyes are closed. He appears to be dazed. You can see the streaks of blood still covering his chest and around his mouth.
I didn't want my life to end like this.
Singleton said what he's accused of doing is hard for him to imagine.
I have so many morals and I'm straight to church and believe God. I can never imagine. I can't remember what it's at. I can never imagine.
Singleton doesn't deny using PCP in the past, but says the murder is totally out of character. He claims he's never been arrested for a violent crime. He grew up in Texas and was living temporarily in L.A. while working on his CD. His sound engineer...
Seems believable, you know. I mean, doesn't he? He sounds well-spoken and kind of normal, and maybe he doesn't remember doing it. But there's no defense anymore to that. I think in 1993, the law changed that you can't have a... Actually, I want to close this one and go out to the next one, right here. You can't use intoxication as a defense. And this is the LAPD side of this case. We did a lot of blood spatter pattern interpretation. Which I one more time, maybe. Here we go. There's about 12 criminalists among them who are qualified to do blood spatter pattern interpretation. It's not a science, it's really kind of an art, and we try to be, you know, keep it simple, basically. We can tell things like if there was combat that occurred standing up versus somebody who was being beaten while they were down. Because if the blood stains are, say, at head level, that tells you something versus blood stains that are, say, 18 inches above the floor. If we find blood stains that are 18 inches above the floor, and the guy says, no, no, we were just exchanging punches. I never hit him when he was down. Well, he probably did. And there we go. Non-Hartner-Brigg, he's the criminalist who did the blood spatter in this particular case. He's very good at this, and he's very conservative. In fact, Milton Grimes, the attorney for Mr. Singleton, told him, kind of off the record, he said, now, I don't want you saying anything that you know, anything wild now. Keep it simple. And he says, no problem. And he says, okay, you know, I'm going to hold you to that. There's another view of the crime scene, the apartment. There's an upstairs apartment. And this is a view. It's a very small place. This is a view from inside toward the front door. Here's a view from the front door. From the kind of the entrance to the hall back out toward the front door. And there's always a crowd. Everybody likes to see the body. And it never fails. There's always people. They'll stay there for 12 hours just to see the body come out. Now, the bathroom is to the left, and the room where the victim is to the right. There's the bathroom, which is a little significant. He had gone in there, and I'll show you later, to clean up a little bit. He had a lot of blood on him. Here's the bedroom, and you can see a little bit of the victim. Her body's there behind the door. Also, there's a bit of a swipe here. Blood is on his arm, presumably, and he was trying to get out the door, and he put his arm on the door to push it aside, and he left an imprint of his arm in her blood. I'll skip this, but the DA's had questions about how long did the assault go. He couldn't say, based on the blood spatter. Where and when it began, he could say pretty much it started in the bedroom. Standing battle, probably not. Body moved, yes, several times. And I'll show you some of this stuff. There she is on the floor, partially clothed. Here's another view. And you can see some of the damages she suffered to her head and chest. There's one of her lungs. There's blood that's dripping from, we can tell, this is elementary blood spatter. These are round drops. They're called low velocity. They just fall with at the speed of the gravity causes them to fall. And they land and they form a circle. And that's what we see here. So he was standing above her at some point, dripping her blood onto her body, her own blood onto her body. Blood in her pubic area. There's blood on the walls, almost. Nan said he told the jury that it was as if he had been finger painting, and there was an instant objection to that. And he was told to refrain from describing it as finger painting. That was on the door. They actually collected that door and brought it back to the lab. We'll do whatever we have to do. I mean, we've cut sections out of floors, we've taken carpets, we'll take whatever we have to take. Standing battle, he said the only remarkable thing is really the blood was fairly low on the wall. Basically, she was incapacitated and down. He was doing a lot of the beating as she was on the floor. You can see that much of the blood spatter, here's 6 inches, 12, 18. A lot of it's pretty much less than 2 feet above the ground. And there she is, a little bit of her lung on her chest. Body moved. Well, they looked at, after they took her body away, they're looking at the carpet. And not a surprise, but she had bled out so much that she had saturated the carpet beneath her. And they lifted the carpet. They looked at the pad beneath it. And there's Lori Lopez. She's had like 3 or 4 of these cannibalistic crime scenes. She's got the worst luck. She's a great criminal. She's one of our best. But she just goes, why me? You know, it's just luck of the draw, or bad luck of the draw. When she's on call, she gets these kinds of crime scenes. The blood seeped all the way to the hard floor. And they actually looked in several spots, and they found that she had been moved, presumably by him, during the assault. She may have been dead as he was working on removing her lungs and stuff, but he had been moving her around from place to place. It takes some time to bleed out and for it to saturate down to the carpet pad and onto the floor beneath it. But we don't know how long the assault lasted. But she had been moved at least 3 times. And that's typical what we do to document blood spatter. We put measuring devices in a vertical and also a horizontal. We photograph each area special. See that? What's that look like? Jordan, what do you think that is? Yeah. Here's a close-up. Remember how long his fingers were? And he had blood on him? Well, at some point, he's under the influence of PCP. He's practically incoherent. He probably lost his balance and reached over and held himself up, and he left her blood on the wall in the shape of his own handprint. There's his hands. Look at the fingers. And look at those fingers. There's more swipe on the door. And questions that the DA had was, among them was there an effort to cover up? Well, probably a bit of an effort. He took a shower, at least made an effort to take a shower. He may have been intending to take a shower, but he may not have actually finished it. He may have went on to something else, which seems likely considering how much blood was on his skin. He changed his clothes. These were heavily bloody clothing items that he had been wearing during the assault. He discarded them. There's some evidence of cleanup, diluted blood. I see it all the time. You know, I just saw it recently, and just before Christmas, a murder of a young lady in Hollywood. Blood in the kitchen sink, diluted like this. The guy had washed his hands before he left. Well, there were witnesses to this. After there was enough commotion and thumping and bumping and loud screaming, neighbors were aware. They just didn't know where it was coming from. But eventually he came outside fully dressed, covered in blood. And the witnesses said he went back inside and later reappeared completely nude and covered in blood. We looked at some bloody shoe prints. Here we go. Looks like what? A foot, right? It's blue because we used a chemical called amido black. It reacts with the proteins in blood. So if you have a little bit of blood on the bottom of your foot and you step, it may be not quite enough to see. We could spray amido black and enhance it. Look at the close-up here. There's something significant about it, this toe here. It'll come up later. But here's the heel. Here's the big toe and then the four smaller toes. But notice that toe. This is probably when he reappeared with his clothes off. But he also had been seen wearing clothing and shoes and, by the way, gloves at one point. And we see what appears to be a shoe print in blood. Here's the shoe print here. There's a little bit of a close-up before it's enhanced. And there's the shoe from inside. You can see that. The heel probably produced those bloody shoe prints. Yeah. What's that? Okay. Let's go through here. I'm not sure the significance of the razor scooter, but there's a little bit of blood. Remember, he was seen wearing gloves, and we were puzzled by that. What's going on there? But he had the gloves on, and the blood was on the gloves. He touched this painted wood and transferred blood, and there's an obvious fabric pattern there. Notice his toes. He's got that long sort of index toe, and that's what we saw in the bloody footprint at the crime scene. There's that toe. It's a little thing, but, you know, and that's that crime scene there. So the victim was assaulted low to the ground, was moved, and there was an effort to cover up. And they were able to confirm the status of the victim as the suspect, later dressed and then later nude. He was arrested with no clothes on. So we do see some pretty horrific stuff. You know, you might be at home on call having dinner with your family, and you get a crime scene, and it's this one. And you go from, you know, peaceful, nice surroundings to that in 1 hour. And then you come home, and how was it? It was bad. You know, how bad? You don't want to know. People don't want to know. They ask, and then I've had people ask, and then they come on, tell me something. And I've had people break down and cry, and then my dad goes, now look what you did. They asked, you know, but I don't do that anymore. I usually don't share stuff like that because you don't know what people can handle. And it's gruesome, but it's certainly not glamorous. Believe me, after you finish a crime scene like that, and I've done about 300 of them, you just want to go home and take a shower and go to bed. You don't want to be talking. You don't want to be thinking about it. You smell it on yourself even after using shampoo and soap. It's just, it's horrible. But, you know, you talk about it with your coworkers, and you get it out of your system, and, you know, you do what you can. Everybody's different. So there you go. Yes.
This is, as you can see, if you weren't looking at any of the pictures that Harry showed, I can appreciate that, but I'm the one that wanted him to show you the pictures. We had some discussion about that last year.
It's pretty disturbing.
Because I wanted you to see the reality of it. In some respects, people like Harry are really the hidden heroes, the people working behind the scenes and doing these kinds of things in order to solve these horrific crimes and find out who's responsible for these different kinds of things. And as you can see, the technology to be able to do this all rests on genetic engineering, because all of the loci and the probes that were used to do this at one point had to be cloned by using recombinant DNA and sequenced and characterized. So the beginning of all this, being able to use this technology is, in fact, genetic engineering. And so it's important to understand, as I said at the beginning before Harry started to talk, that this is definitely not CSI. It's not glamorous, as Harry said.
And it takes weeks. We don't do things overnight. Speeding things up is usually a bad idea. We usually take our time. Because, you know, the crime occurs today. It may be 2 years before it goes to trial. There's no hurry. The legal system has its own schedule. We have the luxury of time. Frequently, the chief of police or somebody wants quick results, and it's just not the right way to go. When we do hurry, usually mistakes are made, and we regret them later. You know, it's like, why do we do that? But we try to rein them in a little bit. But there is a need to know. The public wants to know. The victim's family wants to know. And the chief of police wants to know because he has to report to the mayor. And the mayor wants to know because he has to talk to, you know, the wife of the victim or the husband of the victim. And they wait for us. And we do what we can. We have to kind of balance things, you know.
So, Radina, you had a question.
Yes. Did any of the neighbors call the police before he came out of the apartment while she was yelling?
No. That's not uncommon. It doesn't matter what part of town it is. There was a homicide in Bel Air where the neighbors heard the gunshot and didn't do a thing. And the cops were asking them, you heard the gunshot? You didn't dial 911? Nope. Why not? And it's just the way of life in L.A.
Nick, you have a question.
A couple questions about the cases. From what you know about PCP, do you think that it's like at all probable that what he was saying in that phone interview, that he had no idea what happened and he would never have done that under normal circumstances, blah, blah, blah? I mean, well, you have to be messed up to like probably to do that, but that he wouldn't even have thought of it at all? It just was completely the drug kind of acting on him? Or
That's the $64,000 question. Yeah. You know, I asked Nand, who happened to have been in toxicology also. He knows a bit about the pharmacological effects of PCP, and he goes, you know, the problem with that defense or that claim is that he tried to clean himself up. So he had some awareness of, you know, she's dead, I got blood on me. He just was so messed up that he couldn't complete the showering and get straighten himself out to be at least somewhat presentable before he left the house. He couldn't complete his acts, you know. So the fact that he tried to shower, the jury and the judge were well aware that there was some effort to conceal the crime. So it kind of takes away a little bit of that, I don't know what I was doing, I wasn't aware of it, it's not like me, it's out of character.
Some questions on the science behind what Harry was talking about and how it's done. And Brian?
They did DNA typing, by the way, on the lung from his stomach, and weirdly enough, it didn't come back to her. We don't really know why that is. It could be, I have a suspicion that the wrong people sampled. What happened was they went through the contents of this liquid and sifted out what they thought was lung and picked things that were not lung. Probably, you know, his own biological fluids and things, and God only knows what.
Brian?
About like the gene frequencies that you use for like the P's and the Q's and everything, like how are they established? Like what kind of, who gathered the information? How big was it or anything? Or did you just like pull it out of a book or something?
No, the FBI is sort of tasked by, I guess it's safe to say by law. Congress declared that they shall be sort of the custodians and gather data from a certain number of populations. And what they did, they went to, you know, some of the larger cities, Miami, New York, Chicago, Detroit, L.A., and they picked groups of people, you know, Southwest Hispanic, Southeast Hispanic, you know, Caucasians from each of the large cities, African Americans. They, you know, there's people out there that have, you know, from New Zealand who go out and draw blood from 200 people who are, am I saying this right, Maori? 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 people, and they type them. And then they say, how often does a 15 allele occur at D21? And we've seen it 4 times among 100 people, 4%. And they do that for every population. The data is checked. Frequently, people will say, I have my my database data. I'd like you to type it also. And they'll send each of the 100 or 200 samples to another lab, and they'll repeat the typing and tabulate the results and compare, and they go, it's good to go. And that's really the way they do it.
Betty?
I have an education question, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, as a criminologist, do you want people to know how precise and how accurate DNA can, like, tell you? And do you want people to know how it works?
Like, do I want people to know?
Yeah, for public education, or is that not?
Sure, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Sure, because it, you know what? It's a little self-serving, but when you're testifying, myself or another DNA analyst, we want the jury to be a little bit, you know, able to converse about it. Because it used to be very difficult to discuss it with the jurors or to explain it to them because it wasn't a concept they were familiar with. When the OJ trial occurred, there wasn't CSI. There wasn't, you know, the internet was just sort of starting to get moving. There wasn't this accessibility. This information was not available about PCR, DNA typing, the FBI's, you know, database. People didn't know. And when you would talk about the reliability and the match, they were like, is it really a match? Wow, it's convincing. But then they started producing other profiles. This matches too. And then they started to hear, well, it's not reliable. And yes, it's we prefer that the public is aware. And if they're not, we tell them about it. The jurors are pretty savvy now. It's like the CSI effect, they call it. It's good and bad. The jurors would like us to type every single blood stain at the crime scene. It's not possible. It's about $1,000 a sample. Just financially speaking, there's limits to what we can type. We can't do 100 stains at one crime scene. There's a limited budget. I mean, it comes down to that. So we have to be we have to make some wise decisions on what we type. But we try to balance the DA's request with the detectives, with the expectations of the jury and the public. So yeah, we prefer that they're educated about it. My kids are small, and they have an awareness of DNA typing. My son usually coughs up some good questions usually. So what'd you do at work today? And I tell him, I pushed paper. Come on, Dad, tell me about a case. And I never tell him about stuff like this. But I'll tell him about DNA, you know, and he gets it, you know, it's pretty cool.
You buy DNA testing kits at
Toys
R Us.
You can send your sample into National Geographic and they'll type you.
We talked about that last time.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's continue with questions for Harry outside at our reception. But before we do that, let's give him a really big
thank you
for coming down here.
Thank you very much.
Gloria? Gloria is going to be your little shadow here.